Hello, and welcome to this edition of the Jolly Heretic. Now, I take it that most of you are familiar by now with the case of Professor Jason R. Day, the former professor of the sociology of education at Cambridge University, the relatively young black man who was obviously appointed for reasons of wokeness and who has turned out to be a complete and utter fantasist who has lied about all manner of things about running numerous marathons in a relatively small amount of time, about having been on a television program that was actually on in the 1960s before he was born, that he's plagiarized his thesis and also academic publications, all kinds of other things. It's all been looked at in a great deal of detail by me and others. But what's interesting is that his memoir was not pulled by the publisher and it has now been published. And that memoir, it's called Great and Unfortunate Things, reveals a great deal about him. It reveals new lies that have not been made public yet, and it reveals a great deal about his psychology. It's quite obvious that he's a narcissist. Narcissism is motivated by grandiose ideas about yourself, that you think you're brilliant, and therefore you lie and exaggerate and things like that, by a sense of entitlement, by a sense that you're supreme and perfect, and that's the nature of narcissism. It gives us a fascinating insight into his psychology. And so I want to look at that book today. Before I do so, could you do me a favor? Could you please subscribe? Could you subscribe on YouTube and leave a like and hit the bell and leave a comment and share the video on social media and all this kind of stuff? And could you subscribe to my Substack? That's jollyheretic.com, where I put all the most basic stuff I dare put on YouTube, in-person interviews, vlogs, blogs, films I make, interviews with fascinating people, my new film on Moldova, and where if you like what I do, you would support me for the cost of just a pint of beer a month, which I'm most extraordinarily grateful. Okay, back to the video. So Jason R. Day's book, Great and Unfortunate Things, a memoir with Eve Claxton. It's extremely interesting because it gives us a real insight into things that have actually happened, into things that are probably true. And this is because what he seems to suffer from is not just narcissism, grandiose narcissism, which, as I said, is related to feelings that you're brilliant and you're amazing and you create a narcissistic false self where you tell yourself that you're brilliant and amazing and you look for narcissistic supply and therefore you will exaggerate your achievements and lie and whatever. You will manipulate and exploit people to gain because you think that you're brilliant and you're above them and you will be highly entitled. It's not just that. It's also absurd lying, pathological lying. Lying such that you get caught. I mean, things like saying that he was on 7-Up, which was made 20 years before he was born, is an example of his compulsive lying. Now, this is known as, and it relates to sort of narcissism and other dark triad traits, it's known as pseudo-fantastica. And what tends to happen is that the lies that they tell, all of the self-aggrandizing lies and the lies that cause you to be highly sympathetic to them or whatever it happens to be, all of the sort of manipulative lies that induce narcissistic supply or which bond you to them, which then cause you to do things for them or whatever, they're built on a foundation of truth. Now, why is that? Well, first of all, you've got to be very, very imaginative to just absolutely make things up. So what they tend to do is get things that are true and embellish and exaggerate them. So there therefore will be some things that they say in their exciting life story that are actually true. And secondly, it is extremely cognitively expensive to lie all the time. You have to remember who you've told what to and who you've said what to and whatever. So it's easier to remember your self-aggrandizing lies that increase your status and make people admire you and give you a narcissistic supply and whatever. It's easier to remember them if they are at least based or anchored in a foundation of truth. And so that means that when you suffer from pseudo-fantastica and you will weave your self-aggrandizing, fascinating, amazing, astounding story, which is embellishing the truth and exaggerating and whatever, with elements that are actually true. And so that's quite interesting. And that's one of the things that seems to emerge in this book from the way in which it is written and the way in which it is presented. Secondly, it just reveals new lies. It's like he's forgotten lies that he's told. And so in this book, it just reveals new out-and-out lies. And thirdly, we gain a really an insight into him, into his mind. So I want to go through some of the best examples. So first of all, the writing is he's got a co-author. It's by Jason Arday with Eve Claxton. So this, of course, is telling you straight away that he is incapable of writing a book, which is hardly congruous with him having himself written his doctoral thesis to any significant degree. If he has to rely, has to get an author, has to get a professional ghostwriter to help him write this book for him. However, it strikes me that he must have collaborated with her, because the language is just, it can't just be her that's written this, because the writing is not very good in many places. The writing is the kind of writing that you might find among a rather intelligent, 13 or 14 year old boy who's just beginning to learn how to write, in the sense of how to write stories. And so isn't that good yet, but likes to experiment and whatever. So one of the things you find with people that age that are good at writing for their age is they'll want to experiment with high order words that they've learned, and they give lots of pointless, unnecessary description. So it's not he had a cup of tea. It's, he drank from the brittle red cup, the brown hot milky liquid therein, right? It's poor style, it's verbose, and this is what you see. So for example, he talks about going to a particular low-level yellow brick building with a cold hard glass front door. Well, this is just bad style. This is a completely unnecessary information. By blinking my eyes, I was able to send bright orange and green smoke clouds swirling around the whole of room three. I'd watch them explode against the all-white walls, completely occupied and entertained by the fireworks of my imagination. Because it's completely unnecessary detail. You could argue that it's padding. I mean, it's essentially padding. And I'm surprised, actually, that the professional ghostwriter allowed him to get away with it. And I find it hard to believe that a professional ghostwriter would write things like that. I think this is probably things that he's written, which have been left in. So it's poor style, indicative of him not being particularly intelligent, not being particularly talented. So then we look at other things that emerge that he says that seem to be very unlikely, that are almost certainly embellishments, exaggerations, lies to make him seem more important than he is, to make him seem more brilliant than he is, to make him seem more of a poor victim than he is, and therefore isn't it amazing that he's done so much despite being a poor victim, to fit in with this narcissistic false self where he's the ultimate victim but also the most brilliant and amazing person to overcome all the odds and is just therefore superb and amazing and incredible. For example, he claims that he couldn't read or write until he was 18 years old, and they would try to teach him to read. And this is at a secondary school, apparently. This is at a secondary school in something like 1998. So, and he says that, and when I couldn't read, they used the same pen to bang on my knuckles. And he talks about how much this hurt. So what he's suggesting is that in something like 1998, at a state school in London, he was subjected to mild corporal punishment. I find this to be extraordinarily, of course, this is a way of trying to induce sympathy and say what a hard time he's had, but I find this very hard to believe. Corporal punishment was abolished in state schools in England in 1986. By 1998, Britain was part of the Human Rights Act, and there was a case of a man who, in Scotland, who spanked his, I know what she was, 8-year-old daughter at a doctor's surgery and was prosecuted for doing that, even though it was legal to smack your own children, at the, and it still is in England. But that was the kind of atmosphere at the time, that this was totally socially unacceptable. So I find that very hard to believe. You have anachronisms. So one of the things that he says is when he was brought up in Clapham in the 1980s and 1990s, there were frequent BNP rallies. Well, that's not true. That's not accurate. There were in the 1970s and perhaps the beginning of the 1980s National Front rallies, But they had kind of died down by the time he was born in 1985, and there certainly weren't frequent National Front rallies in the 80s and 90s, and there certainly weren't BNP rallies of any frequency in the 80s and 90s. So he's trying to make out that Britain was this incredibly racist place when he was a kid. Wasn't it hard for me? But yet I overcame it by making out almost that he was born 15 years earlier, when these things were the case in black areas of London. Now, one of the things that you know is he meets his future wife, Debs, when he's a teenager working at a sort of sportswear shop, and he still can't read and write, and she helps him out and whatever. And he says to her, "You must be a beautician." Why? Because you're really beautiful. And he talks about being enraptured by her. This is quite interesting in terms of his psychology. It implies elements of narcissism and perhaps also borderline personality disorder, which is related to narcissism. It's when you have basically highs about yourself. You think you're brilliant and you crash down and think you're awful, and it goes in that cycle. You idealize and de-idealize yourself. You idealize and de-idealize other people. You see the world in this simplistic way. You have problems with emotional regulation. You have a fundamental fear of abandonment. These are the various symptoms of borderline personality disorder. It's mainly a female. It's more a female than a male thing, but you can get it in males. Sometimes it's termed sort of secondary psychopathy. And he's idealizing her. And I wonder if that's actually true. If he did do that, if he idealized her, regarded her as utterly perfect, utterly wonderful, and then perhaps later de-idealized her, as we shall see, and perhaps, you know, therefore was very unpleasant to her. But that's quite an interesting thing. And also the way that he's love-bombing her from the very beginning. He's very charming. This is one thing that you notice with his appearances. He's extremely charming, which narcissists tend to be. The narcissist will tend to find an object whom they regard as equally special to them, and then they will love bomb that object. It's a form of manipulation. They will love bomb that object, so that object becomes strongly emotionally attached to them, and maybe they attract each other, narcissists, and they will be love bombed in return. All kinds of interesting things that I've looked at elsewhere, but this is an interesting thing. He then says that he's beaten up so severely. This is in the public domain at the moment. He was beaten up so severely that he got epilepsy, but eventually he forgave his aggressors and ended up teaching them at a university and becoming the godparents to their kids. Anyway, this seems most improbable. One of the things, as I said, they leak truth. They leak truth, people with pseudo-fantastica, as they lie. So interestingly, he admits to having a problem with lying. He actually admits that directly in the book. He talks about that he has no timekeeping ability. He can't get anywhere on time. He's completely disorganized. And so he has my tendency to make up silly excuses for why I was always late. And he talks about delivering these excuses and people not believing them, or people being skeptical of him or whatever. So he's leaking the fact. He's lightening his cognitive load of always lying and so forth by admitting that he has some kind of problem with lying. We find that he becomes a father during his degree in the first year of his degree, which seems most irresponsible and silly to end up becoming a father when you're unemployed, when you're taking on student debt, when you're doing your degree. That seems a very strange thing to do. But in the first year of his degree, this is what he manages to do. And it's a very interesting insight into, remember, that narcissism involves its grandiosity, its fantasies of incredible achievement and whatever. That's what they're motivated by, narcissists. While he's doing his degree, his university lecturer finishes her PhD, and he becomes kind of almost obsessed with a PhD. What is a PhD? He discovers what it is. He discovers it has high status, and he decides he wants one. So my mind was completely fixated on those three letters, PhD. And his lectures, well, hang on a minute, Jason, old chap, you're struggling to even get your degree. So you should forget about the idea of being able to get a PhD. But no, he's fixated on it, PhD. And later he becomes fixated on the idea that he wants to be an academic at Oxford or Cambridge. Again, not an academic in general, specifically at one of the two most prestigious universities in the country. And later still, he decides that he wants to be a professor. He's not even quite sure what a professor is, but he wants to know, what do you need to be a professor? So it's not about doing the research and doing brilliant research, and therefore, as a consequence, these things emerge. It's he wants these things because they are achievements, because they give you status. And that is reflective of a narcissistic way of thinking. A less narcissistic person might just really, really enjoy their degree and be really good at it and do some really interesting research. And someone might say, you should consider doing a master's, or you should consider doing a PhD. But no, with him, no, he finds out what this thing PhD is. He finds out that it's important, and therefore he wants it. He wants this symbol of achievement, which is consistent with narcissistic personality. Now, all of his online biographies state that he got a first-class degree. Admittedly, this is a first-class degree from St. Mary's Twickenham, which is an absolutely mere university. But this is what it says. They all say the same thing. BBC, whatever, wherever you look, he got a first-class degree. He got a first-class degree. For some reason, he admits in the book that he got a 2-1, which is still respectable, but it's not a first. He admits this in the book. This is weird. I don't know why, because everywhere else it says he got a first-class degree. All of his online bio got a first-class degree. So he's obviously lied to the to people that have produced these online biographies, but then in the book he tells the truth that he got a 2-1 rather than a first class degree. I've no idea why that's the case, but that is the case. That's what you find in the book. He then gets a master's degree in PE from St. Mary's Twickenham, but then it says that this isn't good enough to get onto a PhD course, and not all masters are worth the same. Now that doesn't make any sense to me. If you've got a master's degree, a master's degree is a master's degree. It can be a master's degree from a bad university, which might not help you very much. It can be, if you do a taught master's, it can be a taught master's where you've only just passed, which might not help you very much. Or it can be a master's by research. But I don't really understand, name Phil or whatever, but I don't really understand why he says, though, I was told that my master's wasn't good enough. But that's what he says. But anyway, nevertheless, eventually he gets onto a PhD course. One of the things that he says, he applies for a job. And someone directly says to him that, which he reckons he should have got, but someone directly says to him, oh, your face didn't fit. So, i.e. they were openly racist, which seems most unlikely in the hysterical anti-racist context of the time. But anyway, apparently somehow he manages to get, despite having no publications and no PhD, he manages to get a job lecturing at John Moores University, which is another mayor university. Which is weird, and I can only assume it's because of his, certain physical qualities that he has. And they let him in with no PhD and no publications, which raises the question of how bad must the candidates have been that he was up against if he had no PhD and no qualifications, and no PhD and no publications, and merely a master's degree, and he got the job. What the hell did they have? It's extraordinary. But after 13 months at Liverpool University, he says he got a job. But this is interesting. So he noticed that he's named the universities so far: St. Mary's Twickenham, Liverpool John Moores. And then he says that he got a job after 13 months. He goes back to London, where his wife is and his child is. And he got a job at a local university as a lecturer. However, the money that this local university in London that's unnamed was paying was not very much. And so he got a job working nights at Sainsbury's all night. And then that still wasn't enough. So he got a job working as a cleaner for 2 hours. So it's very much that kind of Homer, that episode of The Simpsons where Lisa wants a pony and Homer can only afford to get her a pony if he takes on another job, i.e. if he does his job at the nuclear power station in the day, then works all night at the Quickie Mart, goes into the house, has a few minutes of sleep, and then carries on. Now, this seems most improbable, and it's interesting that he doesn't name the university. So what I suspect is, really, is that he wasn't working at a university in London at all at the time. He was working nights at a supermarket, and he was then working as a cleaner and then sleeping during the day. That's what seems more probable. They leak truth as they lie. And if he wasn't lying, then why doesn't he mention the name of this London university? Which London university is it? There's loads of them. He also admits, interestingly, to taking the savings of his family and gambling them away playing cards, which would be consistent with elements of narcissism, such as low impulse control, low agreeableness, that you would engage in that kind of gambling of your family's money. That's an interesting admission. And by the criterion of embarrassment, we would expect it to be true. And you can see what tension that's going to cause in the relationship. Nevertheless, in 2014, having had a child in 2007, in 2014, him and Debs get married. And he then manages to get a job at Leeds Beckett University. They make an exception for him, even though he doesn't have a PhD and he doesn't have any academic publications. And he gets the job. And then he goes there and he carries on, apparently, supplementing his income with working in Sainsbury's and working as a cleaner when he's in Leeds, commuting once a week up to Leeds and then going back again rather than moving house. Now, Leeds Beckett haven't denied that he worked for them, so presumably he did. The implication, of course, is that he didn't sleep. He didn't sleep for years. So one wonders what is going on. One wonders why he had, if it's indeed true that he only slept a few hours because he did all these different jobs. Has he got gambling debts? Has he? What's going on? There's something awry because there's no reason why that salary wouldn't be sufficient. They leak the truth, or so as they lie. Then he comes back to London, and he manages to get his PhD at Liverpool John Moores University. You may know from what's been said online that during this he gets brain tumour and has a severe epileptic fit and forgets the entire contents of his doctorate. Now, he said elsewhere that he can't really remember his viva because of all this brain damage that happened to him. But in the book, though, he can remember it in incredible detail. And he describes it in all this detail. Interestingly, he doesn't name his internal and external examiner. He says, that we'll call them Professor One and Professor Two, as though it's a secret. Well, it's not a secret. There's no reason why it should be a secret who your internal and external examiner are. When you have a PhD, you do your PhD, you submit the thesis, and then you have a viva, an oral examination, with somebody from your university, normally your department, who's your internal examiner, but not obviously your PhD supervisor, and then an external examiner, somebody from another university, normally a professor from another university. So why doesn't he name them? I wonder, to be perfectly... And remember that there's a mistake. Remember that his PhD is partially plagiarised. There's a mistake in the title. Literally, there's a punctuation error in the title. And so I really do wonder if there ever was a viva. Maybe they just allowed him to pass it without a viva. That's interesting, because they'd have noticed that mistake in the title, two academics, and they'd had it corrected. Because they passed the PhD, apparently, with minor corrections, which is normative. That's what most people get. That's what I got. It's passed with minor correction. So that's very, very interesting as well. And I wonder if there's shenanigans there. Why doesn't he name them? Why is it a secret? Maybe it's a secret because it never happened, because he can't name them. He also makes out that the PhD examiners, who he doesn't name, were incredibly rude to him. They wouldn't shake his hand when he entered the room, that they wouldn't make eye contact. This seems very unlikely, particularly considering it was 2015 and this was a black man. They probably would have been afraid of being accused of racism if they'd behaved like that. Then we find out that he gets a job in 2017 at another unnamed London university, but is sacked after 2 days because they realise they haven't got the money to pay him. Again, this seems extraordinarily unlikely. And then he gets a job at Roehampton University, which is a mayor university in London. And then he doesn't have to work anymore as a senior lecturer, even despite the fact that he has no publications, as far as I can work out at this time. He doesn't. 2018 was his first publication, so he has no publications. He has a PhD, but he has no publications. But they give him a job as a senior lecturer at Roehampton. You can guess why. And then he says, then I had enough money and I didn't have to work as a cleaner and in the supermarket anymore. So I think that's nonsense. I think that was his first academic job. Or Leeds and that was his first. I don't think he ever worked at these unnamed London universities. And that's why they are unnamed. Then his wife and him break up in 2019. And he doesn't tell us why at all. And I assume it's because she realises, they've only been married a few years, but it's probably come to light. His behaviour patterns have come to light. Things have emerged, I suspect. And therefore, the relationship breaks down. And then we go on. He goes to Glasgow University, Cambridge University. So we find out new things, new lies, but we find out a lot about his psychology. We find out more evidence that he is a grandiose narcissist, and we find out more evidence that he's mythomania. But we find out other things, other interesting things. I think particularly the gambling was a very interesting aspect. So it just tells us more about how this person has, what the kind of man who has managed to con all of these left-wing people who wanted to use him as a means to make themselves feel good and feel morally right. So it's worth, I hate to say it, but it's worth having a look at. Okay, chaps, tally-ho. I will see you all soon. Remember to subscribe, all that, and goodbye.
Are you ready for the future of the West?